Okay, so we're gonna start. Let me go over the agenda. So we're gonna do welcomes and introductions. We're gonna go through the panel. The format of the panel is that each panelist will have 5 minutes to answer whatever comes up for them with all five of the questions. And then in between each panelist, we'll give the panel at large 3 minutes to resonate or respond to what the panelist just said. Said panel. And then we'll have a pair share, just change the energy in the room. And then we'll have some time for question and answer with the panelists. And then our intention is to do breakouts. So as we all know, 5 minutes is like not that much time to get deep into the stories. And what we want to do is give opportunity to have smaller group discussions. And then we'll do a closing. I say all of this with the knowledge that time is unforgiving. And so I'm going to be pretty loose with the structure because I think that what we want to have is a conversation. Awesome. Great. I'm going to hand it off to you. So this is Manny.
Okay, I can introduce myself, that's fine.
Okay, I was going to do an affectionate introduction, but you can go.
My name is Emmanuel Garcia. Is anyone here from Chicago? Yay! I'm from Chicago, from Crossroads Fund. We're a public foundation that gives out grants to different social justice grassroots organizing with budgets of $300,000 or less. And the majority of those groups are doing that work with budgets of less than $50,000. So they're doing a lot and they're doing amazing work. And so I actually come from a poor working class immigrant family. My family immigrated here from Mexico. I'm first generation Latinx. My involvement in social justice came through my intersecting identities as a queer person, as a Latinx person, someone who was trying to find their community on both ends, and then finding my community with Latinx queer people. So we did a lot of organizing work together, and that needed resources. So we would do car washes, events, fundraising events, things of that nature. So philanthropy to me was a fairly new concept 5 years ago, before I interned at Crossroads and then got groomed as a board member and now as a staff member. My primary role now is fundraising, so and communication. So I work with donors at all different levels. My primary role there 3 years ago was part of this national movement, which is a giving project. So we decided, along with other sister foundations across the country, to implement a giving project in our city. So I've learned a lot in that experience as a facilitator, as someone who's holding the space for POC folks, around fundraising and giving, and also just like the internal dynamics that happen. So I think that some people may talk about the Giving Project on this panel. The experience I have is really more as a facilitator and someone organizing donors. And then the other part of that is also that, you know, the Crossroads Fund has existed for 35 years. So, this idea of, working with people with wealth and access has been part of our history. And so I can share a little bit about the experience of working with younger donors now needing this high touch program versus how do we move from that to people self-organizing after that, right? For people to self understand that giving and moving resources is an important thing for our movements, and that we maybe don't need all of that high administrative touch from an organization to do that for us. So I want to say that. And then the other thing I wanted to add was around specifically my own personal giving. As I mentioned earlier, as a POC, poor working class person, a lot of my giving has been with time and resources and knowledge and ideas and, you know, getting pulled in all different directions in that way. And so for me, being at Crossroads Fund for the last 3 years and being involved in, a social justice fund has really taught me the value that of, as a POC person, that I also need to organize my own community around educating around what giving means to the movement. And so what I find most of the time, especially with grassroots groups, is that they don't want to ask their membership base for money. They don't, because of these ideas that people have around money from all levels, they just don't want to pass at the end of the meeting. They don't want to have this like giving model. Mm-hmm. And so fundraising seems to be this constant, like we need help with fundraising. We need help with fundraising. So I'm seeing it from that perspective. And also then thinking about how do we then move POC folks to also give and give generously and to not think about money as this like evil thing that it can be because of all the systems that are holding us oppressed through this like capitalist system. So yeah, it's kind of like you kind of get like a little bird's eye view of all these communities coming together. And so, yeah. So for me, giving has been something that in the last 3 years has increased because I've been having these conversations. And because I feel more comfortable talking about my own background, I think for me to say that I was a poor working class person 3 years ago was like something that I probably would have like never said as a like entry point in a conversation. But I feel like for me, it's really important to claim my identity and be proud of the resilience that I'm here. So yeah, that's pretty much it.
Thank you. Yeah. Okay, awesome. So I'm gonna put 3 minutes on the clock and panelists can just resonate or
I have a question. You mentioned the high touch young people versus self-organized, and that really caught my ear as being a high touch young person. Yeah. I'm just curious if you could say more about that.
Yeah, I think that in philanthropy, there are so many articles right now about like millennials and like how millennials need these high in giving, they need like these high touch programs. They want to be more involved in their giving. They don't want to just write a check. They want to be part of whatever is happening. And I think that is, while it is important, like for example, the Giving Project only holds 20 people. So what does it mean for us as a staff that we can only really do a high touch program with 20 people? What happens to the rest of the people who have the capacity to give, but that are not giving because they somehow don't feel like they're getting something out of it? And so I do think that part of like educating donors in general and communities in general is around giving, and that the movement needs us to move the resources, and sometimes we're not going to get something, you know, in return per se, the way that a high touch program can.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, Manny, I was wondering, because you were talking about that perspective of both organizing within your community as a fundraiser and also your personal giving, like what do you find is a common value or driving force between the two? What are the feelings that are common between the two?
I think giving, well, I think that, you know, personally, I feel like I'm giving to things that I am really passionate about. So immigrant justice is something that for me is really important. And I think that people are always like giving so much of themselves, but we're not putting that of monetary value in that. And so people don't realize the amount of energy and that it takes to build a movement. And so I think that still needs to be all across the board, not just within my own community and POC folks, but people need to know that this takes resources, all of it. And so organizers really need that, those funds, you know, so.
Thank you. Okay, awesome. So I'm gonna put 5 minutes on the clock. The next panelist is Emily Bookstein from Portland. Emily is one of our chapter leaders. And works in tech, and I have the like incredible gift of getting to work with Emily weekly. I organize with her chapter, and Emily is deeply, deeply rooted in personal growth and like the growth of her chapter, which is just like
such a beautiful thing to work with. I'm gonna give you 5 minutes.
Yeah, great. That is a really affectionate introduction.
Well,
thank you.
Really thank you so much. I can introduce Kim after.
Yeah, I shouldn't have skipped it. Yeah, so I guess I'll also start with kind of where my giving comes from. I grew up upper middle class. I'm white. I'm Jewish. And like in a class privileged environment, I had access to education. It was a given that I would go to college. I had access to like the food and the resources I would need. As a result, I think like from an early age, I just like saw the disparity of my life and then like the lives of people in the media or people that I could see around me. And it became really clear that like wealth and class privilege were not earned things. Like these aren't, like I think a common narrative is like the deserving have more and the undeserving don't. Mm-hmm. And that's incredibly wrong. Mm-hmm. And it was really obvious because I had access to stuff that I didn't earn. And like, anyway, I'll put a pause there. What I learned about money growing up class privileged in my particular family was to be really like cautious and anxious about it. So like hold it tight, don't let it go. Like no, you know, be careful. And what was kind of funny is that, like, I didn't learn any skills about how to do that. It was just almost this superstitious, like, hold on to it thing. And it wasn't until I went into the tech sector where I was making my, like, I was making a high income, and that then it suddenly felt actionable to do something with it. Because I guess before, like, the privilege showed up in my life in ways that were, like, investments in me through education or like tons of other resources going into me. When I went into tech, suddenly I had this income that I could do things with. And because I had been part of RG at that point for 2 years, I had an idea that I can redirect my income. Like this is an opportunity to start that wealth redistribution that I believe in on a grand scale with myself. Decided to like set some goals around giving a percentage of my income, which started at 10 and this year will be 15. One thing that I think has been really amazing, and this was one reason I was interested in what you were saying, is so that's my income, but then how do I now also engage other people in the tech industry to also give theirs? And one really great thing has been being involved with Social Justice Fund, which also has a giving project model. It's an excuse for me to go up to my coworkers and have conversations about class and money and giving that I can just do on my own, and like pay forward the donor organizing and all of the educational investment that's been given to me through resource generation and Social Justice Fund. So that feels really important to me to like pay it forward and like expand that network of people who are giving. One thing that feels important, and one reason why I think Social Justice Fund has been a transformative experience for me, and Nitzika is going to say more about how Social Justice Fund's giving projects work. Thanks. So one thing that like really is problematic as for me as an individual giver is the way that controlling money is so arbitrary. Like I'm this random person given control of this money, and I don't want to be a brain in a room being like, this money goes here, this money goes there. So Social Justice Fund has made me part of a collective giving process that feels like a relief to not be re-deepening class patterns around ownership of money. One thing that I really want to let everyone in this room know is, because I know fundraising can be scary because I'm doing it for Social Justice Fund and it's scary to make a big ask. And I want you to know that my personal liberation is aided by letting go of my control and perfectionistic feelings. So anyone in this room and any fundraiser can be helping that personal liberation in someone you're asking by asking them to let go of that control and that perfectionistic need to like have everything, you know, just so. Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe I'll leave it there.
Awesome, thank you. Okay, so I'm gonna give 3 minutes and panelists can resonate, respond, just interact.
I wanted to say that Social Justice Fund Northwest developed the curriculum of the giving projects that we're using in Chicago, and they've been doing it for more than 5 years, and we're doing it for 3 years in Chicago. So I just wanted to give them props for developing such an amazing, giving project. And if you could maybe add a little bit to, in the end, you touched on kind of the personal liberation aspect, if you could maybe just talk a little bit more about that, because yeah, that resonated with me.
Yeah. So I guess one thing that's really slowly become more clear through working with Resource Generation is just the way that having class privilege and also my whiteness has been like very, it serves to separate people. Mm-hmm. And that has like become more and more part of my conscious like thinking about like what's my stake in getting rid of white supremacy culture and what's at stake in like equalizing income, that I will feel like, that I will personally like feel more free and feel more like love and compassion and joy and connection by like having these systems taken away. So yeah, that's, and I know that like personal giving is a really small part of that, but it feels like that's the progress that's happening when somebody asks me and I'm like, I can feel like, oh, I'm part of this letting go now, if that makes sense.
I'm just wondering around approaching others that you work with. I'd like to hear more about like what has been the response, what has been the, you know, what have you found most frustrating and most rewarding?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Emily, you have 1 minute.
Oh, thanks.
In one minute.
So what's been the most rewarding, or
like when you, as you're having those conversations, what's hardest, what's challenging?
Well, I think, okay. What's challenging is, I think, like not knowing other people's relation to their own class or to mine. And there's a power dynamic, I think, coming from the fact that I grew up with class privilege and a lot of my coworkers didn't. Maybe now they have a high income. But as a result, I'm like a little bit trapped in my brain about like, oh, I'm the one who's asking, like, is this creating a weird power dynamic? Am I asking them for something that like I shouldn't be asking for? That's been challenging, but what's really rewarding is like the one-on-one conversation where we talk openly. Yeah, there's a connection there.
Thank you. So next we have Miss Nithika Raj. I refer to Nithika as my femi godmother. Nithika is one of the people in my life that makes it, by existing, makes it easier to be me in a really big sense. Oh, jeez. and the thing that I find really beautiful about Nithika is, I mean, many things, but one thing that comes to life for me is the way that artistry and creativity is constantly present, whether it's like an interpersonal connection or like a institutional project. And I really, really value the way that art is infused into my life through working with Nithika.
I wanted to model actually after AJ Marie Brown and just ask for accessibility. If there's anybody who needs a seat, who will be more comfortable to stay in the session? And if anybody could give up a seat, and there's one open seat here, there's one open seat here. So just please address and be in community as needed. There's actually lots of space here. There's one chair here and three up here.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch over here.
I will start. Oh my gosh, now I don't know where to start. I wanted to share, so I used to be on staff at Resource Generation, specifically organizing young people of color with wealth, but let me tell you how I came to that. I'm not speaking so much as an organizer, but as a person that was like seeking my peers. So it was 2008 when I was newly coming out, had just gotten divorced, and all of this was really connected to class and my experience with my family. And so I was suddenly having this massive sort of politicization and personal, like, coming out, an interesting process. And because my family was really sort of against the divorce and against the coming out process, it's where we had a big financial rift, or it's where I really said, I want a distance from my family's money, and started to just begin the journey around, like, class and thinking about that in a way that wouldn't have happened if I hadn't come out and been having this other part of my life. So soon after that, I'm trying to think what came first. Okay, soon after that, part of the politicization happened in, like, graduate school through this amazing, you know, mentor, teacher, and part of it happened in relationship with a woman who was raised working class and who really pushed me to say, you know, you should give your money away. At that point of time, I had $30,000 in my bank and I had no debt, which was really significant. I had been an international student in the US, had just finished my master's, and my parents had paid for both right when all of this had happened. So the first thing that happened was that super awkwardly, she said, I have a friend who's really, you know, needs the money and you should give her the money. And I said, okay. Because I had no thinking at that point of time about my own class or positioning or just any deeper thinking. So it was really coming from a place of, like, you know, class guilt and shame and, like, I have this. And suddenly faced with the, some of the money I had was, like, wedding gift cash. And it was, like, literally heterosexual, former heterosexual privilege. So all of this, I cooked dinner, my girlfriend and her friend came over, and then I gave her a check. And it was for $13,000, and it was really awkward. Like, that whole evening felt really bad. And in the hindsight and the post-follow-up conversations, for me personally, the letting go of the money part, there was a huge emotional process around it, but I was ready for it. I was politically and values-wise ready for it, and it was a big, like, okay, let's do this, like, actual release of control, because it was a stranger, essentially, to me. But then after that, it was a kind of, oh, now that that happened as badly as it could have, how can this be better? And that was the state I was in when I first heard about Social Justice Fund Northwest and then later on Resource Generation. So in 2010, Social Justice Fund Northwest, which is a public foundation, they started their first ever giving project. And a giving project is really just a giving circle. So getting together members of the community, anybody who wants to be in it. In this particular instance, it was a next generation giving project. So it was 18 people under the age of 40, and it was cross-class, so people from really all class backgrounds. And part of it had actually really developed in partnership with the RG Seattle chapter, where the RG Seattle chapter had been doing the emotional work around money and control, and were ready to move some money and take action, and RG and SJF shared an office. So I was part of this giving circle where 18 people gave between $20 to $20,000 and fundraised from our communities. It was a 6-month project where we had training on, like, race, class, grant making, fundraising. And my significant gift at the time was $1,000 from my earned income. My parents happened to be visiting from Kuwait during the same time, and so I fundraised them to give $10,000, which I was able to do because I was like, if I can give from my earned income, you can give more. And they did, and they came to the SJF house party, and they were just like, what is all this? Like, just the world of foundations in the US is, like, so different to their context. But so in that particular SJF giving circle, there's a moment in time when we, like, class caucus, like, poor working class, lower middle class, upper middle class, wealthy, owning class, like, this whole spectrum. And then in clusters, we kind of made this, like, semicircle kind of thing, and stood, and I found myself standing right at the edge of circle, and it was a really stark experience where all the people to my right were people of color and had the lower amounts of wealth or had poverty in recent experiences, and all the people on my left were, like, wealthy people and were white. And I and one other woman of color were just kind of like standing right next to each other as the wealthy people of color. And it was such an embodied, it was both a really stark experience for the whole group. And it was a really embodied experience of like, I need to find my people, I need to figure this out. Mm-hmm. And it was there that I, you know, got recruited into Archie and like, you know, started organizing at the local level to find other people of color with wealth. Mm-hmm. So, you know, how much time do I have, Kieran?
Oh, I made a decision to save maybe the 3 minutes rather than
I see. I think I just, I will. I'm trying to think what else is important to say. I'll stop there other than saying that what I have continuously found first as a local volunteer organizer in RG to be like, where are the people? Let me become a volunteer organizer to find the people, you know, find the people that I need. And then the same when I was on staff, it was the only position in the country organizing young people of color with wealth. Mm-hmm. I'm now an independent consultant working with several other consultants on organizing high net worth people of color across the country. But it's just continued to be this journey of like an invisible and uncoordinated population that does exist in the country and is a massive resource for social justice movements. Mm-hmm. So, I have reports. Coming out soon.
Thank you. Okay, so we have 1:30 from the 3 minutes to interact with the guy.
What are some of the challenges and rewards of organizing young people of color with wealth?
Okay. I think the reward is, I mean, I just love hearing people's stories. And actually, you know, like I shared with my story, you can't separate it from the wholeness of people's lives. You can't separate it from like colonization and slavery and genocide and all of the things that have happened. And hence that sense of whatever people of color with wealth in this country feel about like we finally have it and like what do we do? And actually people are pretty community oriented, pretty giving oriented. It's not that, but the rewarding part is like kind of hearing people's stories and a lot of the pride and gratitude people have. The challenging part is when people aren't as easily able to see how giving to social justice is connected to like our liberation, even though they are safe now as individuals. And so when people are like giving to the opera and giving to like, I mean, no judgments. It's really just like, there's just so much history, right? Like the new Smithsonian Museum in Washington, D.C., the National African American Museum of History and Culture, it's so important. And all of that stuff, like people's history and visibility is like really important, like by ourselves and for ourselves. And also I think the like actually front lines work of like social change, like it takes years and wealthy people, really high net worth, like people of color are also pretty gatekept and like far away, hard to reach.
Thank you. Yeah. Okay, last panelist. Is a revolutionary mama. By that I mean that she is raising a child, a revolutionary. And she is also interested in being a revolutionary. Patty is super open to being organized and like down for it. And as is evident by when we asked Patty to be on the panel, she said yes to a bunch of strangers who were like, "How do you speak to other strangers?" She was like, "Definitely." And another really special thing about Patty is that she is a resident Detroit person.
What's here for Detroit? Yeah. Thank you for saying those kind things. I really appreciate it, Kieran. I'm delighted to be here. I am a lifelong learner, so to be in a room like this and be sharing this information really does make my heart sing and feel optimistic. And it's not always easy to feel optimistic in this work, so it's just thank you. Thanks for inviting me and allowing me to be here and say what I have to say. So I'm a big fan of 6-word memoirs. Are you familiar with these things? But for me, as someone who likes to tell long-winded stories, it forces me to really narrow down key words that capture what I'm all about. And I was thinking about what inspired me to start giving to social change, and I came up with 9 words. It's the best I could do. saw others joyfully connected in purpose, compelled to join. And so that will kind of inform the rest of what I have to say. So I do believe in the inherent goodness of the human spirit to connect, to seek better in one another, for one another, with one another, even when it's smothered in and really oppressed by fear and anger and lots of things that are out of our control. I have a lifelong sense. What orients me is a lifelong. I grew up with this word. My grandparents were immigrants from Eastern Europe. My grandmother came to Detroit in 1913, so she spoke a lot of Yiddish, which I never. I have about three phrases that I know, but one word is Rachmanis, and Rachmanis, and you have to catch that. It's all here. You can look it up in the Urban Dictionary, actually, and it essentially means that you're motivated by the goodness of your heart, and you're drawn to just helping others. It seems so trite, but at the same time, it's this great guttural word that really guides me. So it's been an evolution for me. I grew up the grandchild of immigrants, the child of parents. My father, Father's Day, I'm thinking about him a lot. They're no longer around, but he was a child of the Depression, came to Detroit to live with his sister, who was 10 years older, having nothing. Got a one-year scholarship. He went to Benton Harbor High. He got a one-year scholarship to what was then Western State Teachers College, but figured out that it only paid for books, didn't pay for anything else. And he came here to work with his older sister's husband, who was in the industrial supply business, this being the Arsenal of Democracy and all. And he made a successful business for himself. He ultimately left being in business with his brother-in-law, but he made a successful business. And by the time I was the youngest of three sibs, came along, and my mother, by the way, also grew up in Detroit, graduated from Central. I was born in Detroit, and I would say these two imprints, one of being a child of the grandchild of immigrants and the ever-present awareness of that and influence of that in our family, and the other being somebody who definitely benefited from my father's rising wealth. And subsequently, the journey for me has been around, being totally gaining from that both inform me. The wealth certainly has put me in a position of being really thoughtful and purposeful around giving back. And for me, that means going back to the city where all of this history for me began, at least modern history, American history. So I would only say that informs how I do what I do. I now, and I'm on my daughter, AJ, who really got me to this place, informs me every day. She's active with RG. She has introduced me to some awesome people in the city who are frontline folks doing great work. They're rabbis, they're reverends, they're Aaron Handelsman, they're Bryce Detroit, they're Jackson Coppell with Solidarity, Shay Howell, so many others. I'm still a student, but I know that I'm in a place where I can use, I also am a student with wealth, and I can use that money to help folks who are on the front line and doing the heavy lifting do that. And the best I can do is do that with respect and do it consistently. And the challenge for me, though, is, how do I plant those? I look at it like helping them plant seeds and really take root and really go on from there. So the challenge for me is, how do I do that over time, which I'm willing to do? How do I do that with as much respect for the power dynamic? And I do that by just listening more than I talk. If I do nothing else, I will have made a great advantage. And then I also bring with me about 3 decades of volunteering for organizations as a fundraiser and as a communicator on behalf of those organizations. So the ability to bring that to the table also puts me in a position of offering, and if it's wanted, to help. I can help. I can help with advice around fundraising campaigns or outreach or things like that. I'm on both sides. I have a hat, a big hat from both sides of that equation now, and I think it's a value that I bring to the table. And I would just like to learn today, do I have a couple more seconds? I could learn today to honor the difficulty. I learned to ask for permission. I ask for permission, or no, for forgiveness, not permission sometimes. So honor the difficulty. I would only say this. Honor the difficulty and complexity of asking for money. Start from that human space when you are meeting with whomever you are meeting. This deeply human space of that awkwardness, that that crazy space of it's hard, it feels humiliating at times, all those things. Start from that space when you're in conversation and starting relationship with your potential people who will be in partnership with you. Okay?
Thank you. Okay, so we have a minute 30 to resonate with.
I answered it all, didn't I?
Yeah, it was just a nine word, really cut.
That's all right. That's okay. Let's go. Let's roll with opening it up.
Yes, ma'am.
See? Yeah. There I am. Hold me in check. Hold me in check.
Okay, cool. So can we just get another round of applause for that? Yeah. I didn't introduce myself, but like, trust me. Here we go. My name's Kira, and I identify really strongly as a militant femme. My pronouns are she and her, and I work for Refresh Generation, and I am really proudly part of the Cross Class, so I'm and the reason why I do that is because I really like sticking into capitalism by like creating cross class relationships and doing it in active partnership.
Sweet. So
what we're gonna do now is we're gonna have like 3 minutes just like change some of the energy in the room. Yes.
Can we get Manny's intro?
Oh my God. Can I affectionately introduce
you?
Yes,
go ahead.
Thank you. Manny and I actually met through this panel, but the word that comes up for me with Manny is brave or courageous. And I think oftentimes we think of brave or courageous as like brave and like hard, courageous. And the reason why that feels so, the reason why that feels so fitting for Manny is because it comes off as so warm and friendly. And I think to hold the identities that Manny holds and still maintain that like brightness is so fucking brave. And I really appreciate that.
Thank you.
It's one of my superpowers. Sweet. Okay, so we're going to take 3 minutes to resonate with each other. So just turn to someone in the room and maybe talk about something you heard. Some prompting questions can be a reaction. What did you hear? And what questions are coming up for you? And then after that, we will actually ask the questions. Cool? Great.
Just like the white noise. I guess.
Yeah. Handy technology.
Thank you.
Yeah, no problem.
Thank you.
Yeah, similarly, we were struck by the comment you made around starting with the awkwardness and actually acknowledging those feelings. And our question was about the power dynamic. How do you do that as an organization who might be in needing to make a donation and really needing to get that money? When we were talking a little bit about the expectation of all fundraisers to walk in with confidence and those that might be coming up. So how do you do that in real life?
Awesome. Thank you. Just we're recording, so that's what we're passing the phone for. And panelists, when you respond, if you could just say the thing that you're responding to. I can respond to cross class. I grew up middle class in the middle of the country.
And then like professional working class, middle class fluctuates. And so I, on RG, we have a cross-class staff. We have wealthy staff and non-wealthy staff. And even those definitions are limiting, right? They're pretty flat. And I was just saying that I like really am proud to work at an organization that I'm not wealthy, and it, for me, it's like an active, daily active resistance against capitalism. Yeah. Thank you. Other folks can respond to that or the other two questions we heard.
I think, well, the question that you asked about how do I think you answered the question, which was around how do you acknowledge, like acknowledging the awkwardness. I think that that's essential in going into a conversation when you're going to ask for money. It's like if there is that awkwardness, you should just put it on the table so that the person is aware that that human awkwardness is on the table on both ends. That would be my recommendation. I feel like just putting it out there. And then the acknowledging, I think as a person of color, like in fundraising and having to ask other people for money, I feel like one, the values that our community, our donors have around money are different than if I were working at a family foundation that was more conservative, where maybe a person of color wouldn't be the first choice to send someone out to speak to a major donor for, you know, a lot of obvious reasons. But I think that sometimes it is one of those things that as a fundraiser, you're going in asking someone for money. And as a person of color, that can be really, really hard because my experience with money or the things that I learned about money may be completely different than the person across from me. So,
thank you. Yeah. I'll grab your question in the next cluster. Thank you.
I was just briefly going to add that I think it's just helpful to start with our stories for all people because they're very humanizing and very like holistic. You know, as I shared with my story, the truth is we all have stories, right? So do donors, so do fundraisers. And for those of us who are in both positions, you just see that. So RG's tool is money stories, kind of like talking about your story with a focus on class in ways that we often don't have visibility of class. It's not that you're just talking about money and class, but it's like a let's not forget in a way that it gets forgotten when we talk about our race or immigration or other stories. And I always say in the consulting work that I do also with coaching, just that the personal is the political is the professional. It shows up, like your everything shows up in your job and your role and what you're trying to do. So if, for example, you know, that thing about fundraising where you just start by saying, here's where I come from and here's why I care about this work and inviting the donor to do the same so that we all get to be human first and then be in our like roles.
So having said that, you made a good point about, well, how do you show up both? Can you come in and say, you know, can we just take a second, a minute, and acknowledge that this is hard. This is hard for us to come to you. It's hard money, exchanging money, and this whole transaction process. That, in my mind, should not take away from the confidence you have in what you're coming to talk about. In fact, I see it as a sign of confidence as a donor that you come in and have that strength of character to be able to say, I can we just for a second now, does that mean every donor is going to respond and say, oh, of course, they're looking at their watch, they're, you know, any number of signals that, you know, get just put it before me. You have to hold firm to your belief, which is the right belief, that conversation with donor is maybe the beginning and should be seen as the beginning of a conversation. What makes it this tension is that you need this money. And so that's always going to be there, but you have to keep your eye on that a relationship must be built for this interaction, this partnership, to be sustainable and to ultimately be rewarding for everyone. Does that make sense? So one should not take away from the other around confidence versus putting it out there, just as my co-panelists have said, around it humanizes everybody in the room. It's a great place to start.
So I'm going to take three more questions.
Okay. How do you navigate what the ask is for a person of color who has a high income but yet doesn't have the economic security that comes with generational wealth and that privilege? And so how do you navigate that?
Thank you. I'll take two more questions. Did your hand up?
We were wondering, our pair, about, you know, obviously your perspective as donors comes from being a really awesome perspective, but not all major donors are kind of in that space of thinking of giving as part of this collective liberation. So what are some ideas you have about how you start to shift that conversation with your donors? Great question.
Thank you.
I have a question. So I was wondering, because there's a lot of one-on-one donors kind of stuff that happens, and I think when I was talking to you earlier, but having a group of people, how do you even get those people? How do you, how do you get that group? Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And how do you do that process as well?
Thank you.
I can answer the how do you get the group question on that end in terms of the outreach for our giving projects. And just for the Chicago folks, we're having one in the fall, so if anyone's interested, that's one way. And then the other thing is that, you know, Crossroads Fund has like a 35-year history of, you know, organizing donors and giving out grants. So we have a community built in. And so, you know, we put it out, for example, through our listserv, and there's no way that we know the giving capacity of people on that listserv in terms of who decides they want to be part of this project. So sometimes you don't know. So, for example, in the first giving project, we had someone who had the capacity to give over $20,000 as an individual. And then, you know, it varies. So you just don't know, like, the giving capacity of anyone, whether they're a person of color or they're a white person. So that was one way. So really, that's the outreach that we're doing, is really through our community of people and just putting it out there for anyone who's interested. We're not necessarily specifically asking people to come in through their class, per se. Yeah.
Thank you. I wanted to address the question about not all major donors are bought into the collective liberation model. I mean, I think that's a great question, and I'm like trying to like go back and figure out, I'm like, well, how did I get here? I mean, at least as far as I've come, I certainly have a long way to go. But I guess what I can't help thinking about is like getting people in a room with other people to talk about this. And I know that that can be really hard to do if you're a nonprofit and like if your people and resources are already kind of stretched. If there's a way to funnel people to organizations that are already doing this, like Solidaire is a donor network that I think has like a pretty strong analysis. There's Resource Generation, there's Social Justice Fund. And I know that maybe this is not a completely practical suggestion, because it also means like spreading donors around different nonprofits, and I know that that's a complicated thing, but I guess I'm just thinking there was really no replacement for me of like a peer group that was showing me the way. So like being around other class privileged people who were like further in their analysis and could like help me think through and kind of like debug my class privilege shit. So I guess I know that that's maybe a complicated suggestion, but like thinking about what resources are out there that can like get people to have those conversations.
To the question about newly earning like folks of color or high income earners for whom it's new sort of money in the family, I think it's always good, you know, if we can just give people lots of options to engage. Sometimes people can, if they're in a high earning industry, then they can engage corporate giving, which is actually great because of the corporate match. And then people get to experience that feeling of actually organizing money and having it matched, and they feel the impact of that. And that's sort of like, oh, I can take an action and it produces resources for good immediately, people sort of self-inspire and then they're like, oh, I have ideas, let me do this, who else can I talk to? So from what I've heard, especially for folks in like the high earner, like tech or business industries, it's good to like identify who the leaders are. They're your potential donor organizers who will then organize within the institution. And just for them to have other options other than that they make a significant gift, that holistic engagement piece, if they can like make a connection or if your group can do a presentation at work or something, if there's a way that there can be mutual sort of exchange for a while until it's really seen that this is in the collective self-interest. So.
To the, how do you find the donors? I agree with Manny, you often don't know, and you should treat everyone as having the potential or knowing someone who has the potential. You just never know how one conversation may lead to, so you have to really approach it that way. The other side I would say is you can absolutely do research on finding out who gives what to whom, and it takes about, even I, a relative tech neophyte, can do research. It's extraordinary, actually, what I even found out about myself. So you can do research and you can find often, for me, it's not just how much someone may give, but to what they give, because that gives you a sense of what their priorities may be. I have a couple just points to that I didn't say when my initial remarks, that I just practical points that may answer a few things for you. Pardon me?
I'm gonna give you 1 minute.
Okay, good. Ask other grassroots, to Emily's point, ask other grassroots organization who funds them. That's how you find owners. And there is a scarcity. There is a really difficult dynamic about that. I can tell you that I'm part of a group of funders who are working hard to improve our transparency with one another around the projects that we meet on a regular basis. We talk about the projects we're interested in. Doesn't mean everybody at the table is interested in the same project, but it's the beginning of it. It's an awareness building that certainly helps. And there has to be some effort made to improve the transparency also among recipient organizations who align generally under a similar umbrella. And because if I give to Detroit Jews for Justice, I'm likely to give to other groups that work as allies in our community. If I give to Freedom House, I'm interested in supporting work with refugees. And there is that. I also want to say, as a trustee of a family foundation, two family foundations actually, my father's named after my parents and one with my name on it. So the one with my name, I'd have a whole lot more to say about it. And the one with my father's, I would say to you, so I'm at that table, right? And that table, that if you came to that the Kahn Family Foundation with that with an ask and came to me with the ask, it's going to get two different receptions. Mm-hmm. I implore you to not assume a no from a family foundation means that everybody at that table said no. Mm-hmm. They don't all say no. So never, if you had a reason for going there in the first place, you saw some indication or somebody told you, you know, stay in the conversation. Don't walk away. Stay there and find out who the trustees are. There are often silo. There are, what do you call that? You have separate pots of giving, and they give independently, by the way. So they were at the table. They had they gave you a conversation, assumingly. Stay with them. There's somebody there who agreed with you. Okay? Grassroots channel. And that's it.
Okay, awesome. So I'm going to take 3 more questions.
Despite slavery, the institution of slavery, Jim Crow, economic exclusion, there's a long history of Black people in America being philanthropic. What I find often is that groups of individuals, Black people, are not honored for their contribution, and it has to do a lot with
what they're giving to. Mm-hmm. And I know people mm-hmm. who are trying to figure out where is our money going to end. Yeah. I've just returned to Detroit. And I've worked for different organizations. And I'm here in Detroit, and individuals are asking me from other places, how do we get to Detroit? Where is it going to matter? I know nothing about tech. Because often there's a particular kind of generation, let's say of the baby boomer, model that seems to be left out of that dialogue. And I guess what I'm asking is, how is that kind of dynamic taken into consideration, and is it taken into consideration? And I really appreciate what you offered.
My name is Alex. I'm from Chicago. One of the problems I guess I have is that there's always these quotas or these planned deliverables, or there's always these expectations. And a lot of the most important work that I've seen and that I'm seeing in my communities is queer people, black femmes, as collectives, as individuals, taking care of their community and really transforming and shifting culture in these huge ways. I see a lot of people showing solidarity for these white people. And so I just want to the question I would ask is, what are we all doing to kind of get rid of these expectations and these ties to the work that's going on, and how do we really center the people that are doing impactful work that are not tied to organizations and that are really doing collective co-op models that are outside of these institutions, that are outside of these nonprofits, that are doing the work that's really kind of transforming. So how can we make that more, how can we uplift that work? Yeah.
I'm gonna take two questions for this round. Juicy questions. So, it's about 5 minutes for this round of answering, so you guys got it, right?
So I wanted to just say that, at Crossroads we give out unrestricted money. So we don't have any restrictions on, once you get the money and you do whatever you want with that money, because whatever, so it's not project based, we're not giving you the money so that you could give us deliverables or quotas. And then the other thing is that you also don't have to be a 501c3 to get money from Crossroads. So we're supporting groups that maybe don't want to formalize themselves because they're not trying to create, institutions or, be part of the nonprofit industrial complex. I would say that model can happen and it's very real. So, and then I just wanted to maybe get clarification on, are you talking about direct services? When people value what money is going to certain groups or?
Well, your outreach to individuals who are looking to find support for how do we fund our contributions? A lot of people, there are some people that exist out there that say, nobody's really trying to come and do this. We have no idea where to do this. And so we just do the same thing over and over year after year.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I think that part of it is these ideas or assumptions that people have around who has access and who has wealth and who can give. I think everybody can give at different levels, at different capacities, and it should be treated equally and as important. So this notion that we should just be looking for wealthy donors or whatever assumptions and ideas we have about that needs to be change. And so, yes, there are tools for you go to a gala and you can go down the list of who was on that host committee and who's giving to what. So there are ways, and there's wealth generators, if you're a bigger organization, there's that research is out there, but that's not the human, like, personal, like, social justice liberation model. I think we need to be including everybody, and we need to be asking everybody at different capacities. And what if someone has a capacity to give $20,000 and someone has a capacity to give $200, both are equally, like, amazing gifts, because they're coming from a place of their capacity to give. Mm-hmm. And so we need to honor everybody's gift in that way.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. To the question on, you know, how do we learn about the groups that exist, I think that that's just a huge gap. It is really, there's a vast difference between, if you look at, like, big funding institutions and, like, frontline groups, and especially post-election and stuff, there's just, like, a big gap as to, like, how does everybody learn about each other. But there's a lot of also, you know, philanthropic advocacy going on from, like, sort of radical people within donor organizing, resource mobilization. One specific thing I know that is in the works right now is Solidaire is working on, Solidaire is a giving network. They're working on a portal that will help groups get their applications into a portal so that when you apply for a grant, I'm involved with a rapid response, like, fund, post-election fund called the Emergent Fund. And so, for example, if a group submits a grant to the Emergent Fund or to several other funds like this that exist, that all of these applications could go into this portal, and then several foundations or several groups of funders would hear about groups and would have access to that without the group having to apply over and over. So just to say, there's some awesome, I think, strategies that are being built out right now. It will take a while for them to, like, get to scale. It's in the super, like, for, it's, like, literally in the design prototyping phase right now, but it's expecting to launch in July. And they're gonna start with, like, small groups and, like, test run with some groups and funders. So, but actually, if you imagine this going to scale, it could, like, stop the way that old school institutional funding happens. Like, people will never wanna wait to, like, write a long application for, you know, like, a Ford Foundation, even though Ford is, like, funding lots of awesome work, and they fund some of our work too, and I appreciate them, but the process is really slow for what we need right now. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, things are happening.
Can you repeat that name?
So,
oh, I'm sorry.
Right. Thank you.
Great. Yeah. We have no more time. But I'm gonna give each of you a minute to just, like, make some closing remarks, and then the next thing's on the agenda is that Ellie. Ellie is a chapter leader in Chicago with Resource Generation. A magical thing about Ellie is that I feel like Ellie's queerness is always palpable, and it makes me feel very safe. And I see them, like, I see their queerness through, like, all of their work, which is really excellent. So what we're gonna do after the closing remarks is Ellie has been taking notes, summarizations, is that what it is? Great.
Distillations of strategies.
Cool. So we'll go through that. And then our intention is to break into smaller groups to dig into some of the themes that we're seeing. So definitely going to continue the conversation. Does that sound right to folks, or do you want to keep doing the question answer model this way? You're like, no, I got this. Okay, great. There's a sign-in sheet somewhere?
Yes.
Anna. Cool. Thank you. So I'm actually going to start with Patty. 1 minute.
I'm just, you know, I came in with some points I wanted to make and some questions I wanted to ask of all of you. And I would just say, you know, don't, the hardest thing to overcome is inertia. So ask, go to the places, stretch yourself, practice that asking. Look for the ways to bring, I look for connectors all the time. I rely on them. Who can introduce me to folks doing good work in this realm? Do that for yourselves. Look, who's getting funded? And I know, this is this dynamic. We're just gonna have to push up against that because you can make the case, I can make the case, that it makes everybody stronger. It makes community stronger. It makes the organization stronger to work collaboratively in this. And I would also say, going into a grant collaboratively is very appealing to me as a funder. I can make a more substantive commitment because it's that old adage, like, sometimes some things you're not asking for enough, Ask for enough. You're worth it. You're worth it.
What do I want to say? One of the things, I'm on the board of Astrea, and as we've been kind of rallying our board members to fundraise, one of the things is also that a lot of us have just like fears and stuff around asking for money and kind of like starting with that. You know, like even if we have been major donors when it comes to asking for money, we all have various things come up. So just being super real with ourselves and starting there and saying, what's that about? And then do the thing that's actually exciting or easy for you if you have that choice. If it's part of your professional job and you have to do something, and if you have some choice about like, I'm gonna have birthday donations or an event or do major donor or do this, kind of like lean towards what feels heart connected and exciting for you as much as you can, like play to your strengths and your desires. And I wanted to talk about this report for one more minute. To your point earlier, this report is called the apparitional donor because the giving, the generous giving and moving of money and resources by communities of color is huge and very undernamed and undervisible. So this piece of it, and it talks about giving patterns by racial groups, and that there are actually over 2 million people of color with over like $1 million in liquid assets. And so let's organize everybody.
Awesome. So one thing I guess I want to talk about briefly, a question came up yesterday. What do you say to people who don't have access to high donor or like high money donor networks? That's a great question. And one thing that came to mind is something we talk about in resource generation, which is like, how do you leverage privilege? And there's many kinds of privilege. Like if you've been to a higher educational institution, if you have workplaces or know people, or there are so many different ways. And if your organization's having trouble like finding that pool of people, seeing who in your network maybe does have a connection to another group, or like how to jump through associations to get there. Like I feel like I'm playing that role in some ways in the tech industry. Like it's a tremendous privilege to be in that space. And I want to be able to be a connector between the tech space and places that don't have access to that.
Thank you. Okay. All right, bring us up.
Well, I just wanted to say that, and I feel like it's really important to name this, is that we need to be, that we all come from different backgrounds, different experiences, different woke levels, if you will. And one of the things, just from the track from the conference this year and the moment we're living in, I think it's important to remember that we're all in this together and that we are a unique group of people who is interested in social change work. And so no one's, dispensable, and that we need to be more generous with each other in terms of like hearing our stories and listening and doing more active listening with each other. So I just wanted to put that out there for whatever it's worth, because I think sometimes it's easy to think that, there's an outside world that doesn't want this to happen, and we need to remind ourselves that we're all trying to make a difference.
Thank you. Okay, let's give it up for the panel one more time. Thanks, panelists. Okay, so I'm gonna read through the strategies. I have dyslexia, so just bear with me. And then I think each of the panelists can just name a small group that you're interested in convening, and also y'all can convene. Y'all are also experts, so y'all can definitely convene. So some of the strategies: put awkwardness on the table. Sex positivity. Share stories. Resist silence and taboo around money. Awareness of power dynamics when POC fundraisers make asks. Even with established community, you don't know people's giving capacity. For example, when not bringing in, wait. I can't read that. So the next one is shifting conversations with major donors. Get them in the room. Send them to other donor organizations. For example, Solidaire, Resource Generation, Social Justice Fund. There is no substitution for peer groups. Organize folks with earned wealth, especially POC, around workplace giving. Identify leaders in donor organizations. You never know people's potential, but you can research how much people give. Ask other grassroots organizations who fund them. Don't assume no from a family foundation means that everyone said no. Stay in conversation. Unrestricted grants don't have to be 501c3 with some solid justice foundation, social justice foundation. Everybody can give at different levels and should be honored. It's not liberation to just pursue wealthy donors. Solidaire portal pools application for several funders, which is in the early stages now. Cool. Okay, so if you all want to quickly name small groups that you're interested in convening or conversations that you're interested in going to from, and then we can move. Oh, sorry, one last housekeeping. Adam is going to, in lieu of evaluation forms, Adam's going to pass around sticky notes and note cards. If you could put plus deltas for this conversation and this panel, we would love it. This is an ongoing panel, and so we would love the feedback.
And a plus is just maybe something you appreciate, a delta would be something
you might
want a panel like this to do differently next time, so we can make this better. This is our second time doing it. So.
Thank you. What's a small group you want to talk to?
Yeah,
totally.
Sorry.
No, please.
I need a minute. I was gonna say anything that I talked about, you can come talk to me about.
Right.
Sweet. Okay. Do you guys want to pick corners of the room?
Yeah. I'm staying here.
You're staying there. Okay.
Just a time check too. I know there are 10 minutes left before the end of the session, so we probably won't get deep into these.
Yeah.
But.
Cool.
Should I just go to a different corner?
Yeah, just go to a different corner.
And then if no one's in that corner, I'll just go to a different group.
Yeah.
Or I'll just stand by myself.
Yeah, yeah. Just like processing.
All right.